Welcome to the Fundamental Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Paul Saladino. This podcast is the result of my relentless search to understand and correct the roots of chronic disease and illness. In this podcast, I will share with you everything I have learned about how to live the most healthy and radical life possible. Thanks for joining me on this journey. What is up, you guys? I am so glad you are here with me this week. It's kind of crazy right now. I did a podcast earlier this week on coronavirus. If you are interested in that one, you will find that on my podcast, Fundamental Health, as well. Or this week's episode is with Max Lugavere, and I am excited to share with you all of the conversations with Max, who has a new book called The Genius Life. Max is a good friend of mine. We agree on many things. We don't totally agree on polyphenols, but I respect his opinion, and I think that discourse is healthy and fun. I hope you'll enjoy this conversation. We had some interesting thoughts on sleep and melatonin and insulin resistance, and Max is an all-around great guy and super smart and a good writer. His first book was a New York Times bestseller. It is called Genius Foods, and this is his second book, The Genius Life. So check out The Genius Life. If you were at home in social distancing and just hanging out, it would be a fantastic read. My new book, The Carnivore Code, would be another fantastic read. If you guys haven't seen that, you can find it at thecarnivorecodebook.com. It is crushing it. It is already a bestseller, and I am excited about seeing it in broader distribution soon. Stay tuned for those exciting details in the near future, but please check out my book, The Carnivore Code, and Max's book, The Genius Life. And if you guys are all stuck at home, one of the things people are kind of panicking about right now is food delivery. You may be going to the grocery store and finding that a lot of stuff is out of stock. You know what is amazing right now is grass-fed, grass-finished, regenerative agriculture meat delivered to your door, which is always a good thing. I've been able to connect with some amazing new folks in California, the folks at Buy Ranch Direct. That is B-U-Y. RanchDirect.com. It's another regenerative farm in Northern California in the Sierra Nevada Mountains that I am so stoked to promote. You guys know that I am a big fan of regenerative agriculture. In fact, it is at the center of my being. It is something I am so passionate about. And I'm so excited to share with you guys amazing farms like this that are doing good work, doing the regenerative agriculture work, putting nutrients back into the soil and really, really healing the earth in the best way. We know we cannot regenerate the land without animals. This is the way forward for all of us. So buyranchdirect.com, they have some amazing stuff going on right now. In fact, they have all kinds of steaks. They do beef, bison, they do yak, they do turkeys and lamb and chickens, they do pork, and it is all well cared for in these pristine lands. They have these amazing freezer stuffer boxes now. You can get 25 pounds of meat for $250, so that's about $10 a pound, but that includes New York steaks, ribeyes, London broils, chuck roast, all kinds of stuff. Check them out at buyranchdirect.com. If you use the code CARNIVOREMD, you can get 10% off your first order. Let me know what you guys think of this. Again, I am so excited to promote farms like this that are doing things right, grass-fed, grass-finished, stewards of the land, increasing the carbon-carrying capacity of the land, and putting organic matter back into the soil. This is something I am so passionate about. Check them out, buyranchdirect.com. Use my code CARNIVOREMD. And let me know what you think of their amazing steaks and get some meat delivered to you. You don't even have to go to the store. Don't panic. There's meat out there. Another farm for you guys on the East Coast or the middle of the country is my old friends, my good friends, my original friends, probably the originators of the regenerative agriculture message, at least for me, White Oak Pastures, whiteoakpastures.com. I spoke to them the other day. They are trying to produce as much as they can right now. They are realizing that a lot of people are really in need of deliveries and want to have as much meat as available as possible. As you guys know, they are grass-fed, grass-finished as well. They are doing regenerative agriculture, which is rotational grazing. They are a sixth-generation family farm, 150 years in the family, and for the last 20, they have been doing regenerative agriculture, which is the right type of farming. It's essentially grass-fed, grass-finishing in the right way. It puts nutrients in the soil. So we were going to have a get-together at White Oak in May. We're going to have to push that out to the fall, but we are still going to do White Oak Chella. It's a celebration of regenerative agriculture in Georgia. We're going to be doing bonfires and axe throwing, but it's probably going to be in October or November. So stay tuned for details there. We're not going to do it in May. I apologize, but you guys can still get some freaking amazing meat from White Oak Pastures or organs. They are premier organ purveyors. It's where I get majority of my organs from because I love them so much. Use the code CARNIVOREMD for 10% off your first order at White Oak Pastures at Well, as well, as White Oak Pastures at Well, at White Oak Pastures as well. And again, do not stress about where your good food is going to come from in these crazy, crazy times. Another source of amazing, amazing nutrients are my friends and family at this point, basically my blood brothers and sisters at Ancestral Supplements, ancestralsupplements.com. They have freeze-dried, so these are low-temperature desiccated organs and colostrum and all kinds of good stuff from grass-fed, grass-finished cows in New Zealand. I know a lot of people are thinking about how to make their immune system as healthy as possible right now with the coronavirus stuff going on. Again, I did a whole podcast about that earlier this week. Check that out. But one of the things we can be sure of is that grass-fed, grass-finished meats and organs are a huge part of that. The first two sponsors of the podcast you can get your meat from, and you can maybe get some organs from them, but if you can't get the organs, or you don't want to eat the organs, or if you're traveling, or if you just want to get a host of great organs that are hard to find in general, Ancestral Supplements are your people for this. You can get thymus, which is the immune gland in the human body. You can get colostrum, which is a collection of bovine serum immunoglobulins from the milk, and all kinds of good stuff. And I think that definitely eating liver and pancreas and spleen and thymus are fantastic ways to support our bodies. You guys know that I love this. Nose to tail is going to really improve all of us no matter how we do it. So check out ancestralsupplements.com. You can use the code SALADINOMD at their Shopify site for 10% off. They are putting back in what the modern world has left out. And my goodness, the modern world has left out a lot these days. We all know this. So, all right, without further ado, please support Buy Ranch Direct, White Oak Pastures. Buy Ranch Direct is buyranchdirect.com. Check out their boxes, whiteoakpastures.com. You can use CarnivoreMD at either of those sites for 10% off your first order and get some good meat delivered to you. Stock your freezer and be safe and healthy and sound and calm in these crazy times. Stay healthy, eating good food, and support your overall health by eating organ meats. And you can use the desiccated organ supplements from Ancestral Supplements as a fantastic adjunct to all of this, ancestralsupplements.com. I love all of these people. I am so happy to support them all. The final sponsor of this podcast is Native Deodorant, especially in these times and never in any time, really, do we want to be putting things that are fake in our armpits to deodorize us, but we also don't want to necessarily smell like a caveman. One of the things I like about Native is that they're creating safe, simple, effective products that are non-toxic. They have over 8,000 five-star reviews on across their platforms. They are formulated without aluminum, parabens, or talc. Those are badness. Those are xenoestrogens and other things that can be toxic to us. They are filled with ingredients that are found in nature, such as coconut oil, shea butter, and tapioca starch. They're not tested on animals, and they do free shipping and returns. This stuff actually works. You smell pretty good with this, and again, it is not going to contain aluminum or parabens or talc, things that are often found in other products. So they are making all sorts of great scents: cucumber and mint, eucalyptus and mint, coconut and vanilla, and there is no risk to try. They offer free returns in the United States. I tried this stuff myself. I use it commonly, and it's good. It doesn't smell, you don't end up smelling like a caveman. You end up smelling good, or a cavewoman, and it worked really well. So check out nativedeodorant.com. You can use the promo code SALADINO for 20% off your first purchase with nativedeodorant.com. SALADINO for 20% off your first purchase. Support them because they are doing good things in the world of bringing us products that are not full of junk. All right, you guys, onto the podcast. Love you all. Listen after for what is going on with me. Max Lugavere, welcome to the podcast again, my friend.
Thanks for having me on.
It's good to see you.
Same.
The last time we did an episode before the podcast, you were like, I'm doing a secret project. I'm working on a book.
I'm working on a book.
But you can't tell anybody. So I've been keeping it a secret.
Oh, man. Thank you.
And now we can talk about it because your book is coming out.
It's coming out. Yeah. It's called The Genius Life.
I love it. Just like I really appreciated your first book, which is Genius Foods.
Yep.
so people can refer back to our first podcast when we talked all about that kind of stuff. And this one is called The Genius Life. We were chatting about it a little bit before we jumped on the show, but it seems like this one is cool. It's like a 360 lifestyle perspective, which I love. So we're going to dig into all those aspects. Is that how you describe it?
It is. Yeah, totally. It's basically a book packed with science, but it also contains a lot of sort of simple hacks that you can integrate into your day that are going to have big wins in terms of your health in the long term and how you feel in the short term. And it's a continuation from, my work on Genius Foods, which is really sort of what I consider to be the ultimate, perhaps unofficial nutritional care manual to the human brain. And I know that we diverge on different, nutritional philosophies, but yeah, I became really interested in this topic when my mom developed dementia at a young age, and I had a background in journalism, and I was able to thankfully sort of filter all of the, my experiences doing that for many years, into becoming a bit of a private investigator, an independent investigator to understand to the best of my ability why this would have happened to a woman at such a young age. And it led to, this deep dive into how food affects the brain, sort of risk factors that are related to, Alzheimer's disease, other forms of dementia, Parkinson's disease, things like that. But, the body's relationship to health doesn't stop at nutrition, as you know. And so neither could I guess you could say.
Max Lugavere, PI.
PI, yeah. Yeah, I mean, as a journalist, you're trained certainly not as rigorously as an academic scientist, but you're taught to ask questions, to investigate, to be able to parse out credible sources from perhaps those that are less so, to be a skeptic. And I've never been interested in politics or any of the things that, I guess typical journalists are interested in. My passions have always been health and nutrition and science, and so I was sort of able to kind of pivot and use that to understand why this tragedy was happening in my life. I think many of us are motivated by whether it's our own personal health issues or health issues that our loved ones are facing. For me, I've been pretty lucky in that I've never had any major health scares. I've always been, I've been pretty privileged in terms of health. I was never, really overweight, but my mom, who I love more than, anybody else on the planet, she got sick at a young age, and it was really tragic to see. And as the treatment options for people with dementia are very limited. And I've had the ability to the good fortune to be able to go to some of the top sort of like cathedrals to Western medicine that we have in the US. And in every instance, I was met with what I've come to call diagnose and adios. And I know that that sounds kind of callous, but it's true. In every doctor's office, I was met with just bleak desperation. Maybe a physician would tweak, the dosage of a drug that my mom was already on, but none of those drugs were doing anything good for my mom. And I can say that with certainty. And so I just wanted to, I felt entitled to answers, and I felt that I was able to sort of stand up and do my own research and sort of network and have conversations with some of the most brilliant minds in this field. And that began about, 8 years ago, 9 years ago. And here I am today, with now going on my second book, which is crazy, but it's all motivated by the fact that I've been touched by real illness, and it's in many ways, been very painful to contend with. And my hope is that by adhering to some of the principles that I set forth in The Genius Life, that people will be able to hopefully avert some of these conditions.
I love it. I love what you said about your journalistic training. And I think that there are a lot of journalists who have done great work. Nina Teicholt, many others have this inquisitive questioning, not satisfied with what they are told mind, kind of this curiosity, almost like a detective, like you said. You're a private investigator, you're a detective. This is Max Lugavere, PI. You've kind of got the hunch, right? You're a bloodhound. You're like, there's something more here. And I think you're right. A lot of scientists are trained that way in traditional science to some extent, but I'll tell you what, in medicine, we're not trained that way. And I think it's such a tragedy. And maybe this is just the way I received my medical training. Maybe in other medical situations or other people received their medical training differently, or they sort of incorporated into their paradigm differently than I did. But I've always been similar and been curious. And I never felt that that was fostered in medicine. And I hope that will change. And I love that about what you're doing, is that it's just this curiosity with the hope of finding something that's going to help people long-term. Truth seeking, my man.
Yeah. I mean, I think like, you know, PhDs kind of do this, you know, but the way that that works is that they're focused on these really sort of niche areas. And sometimes PhDs have difficulty in translating what they're learning, you know, at bench to bedside, to use a sort of medical term. But yeah, I mean, I really, you know, became dedicated to understanding and integrating my learnings into my life and then leading by example, you know, wanting to know about the foods that I'm putting into my body and reaching for foods that are, you know, that I think the research suggests are going to be more beneficial in terms of, you know, optimal brain outcomes, living in a way that supports optimal body composition, metabolic health, and things like that. Because I think that for too long, the veil has been pulled over people that were not credentialed. You know, I disagree with the notion that you have to go through academic training and get a PhD to know about nutrition and how to properly feed the human animal. Same with medicine, really. I mean, I think that, like, you know, healthcare is something that's been like co-opted by the pharmaceutical industry, when healthcare is really something that you're doing when you're pushing your shopping cart through the supermarket, when you're debating with yourself whether or not to peel yourself off the couch to get to the gym. I mean, that's where true healthcare and wellness occurs. We go to the doctor typically for sick care. I mean, you know this. People don't make appointments to go see their doctors when they're well. They do it when they're sick. And so I really just sort of took a no holds barred approach to, you know, educating myself and being sort of honest with, you know, the things that I'm in, that I am able to understand and grasp and have a firm, you know, sort of mastery around, and then being totally open and vulnerable about the things that I don't fully understand, and reaching out to other experts, people like you, people like, you know, all the people that I've been privileged to interview on my podcast. And so, we were talking when I recorded you on my podcast about, you know, being a truth seeker, and how that's probably the one good thing that you and I were both able to take away from the recent Wilkes Kresser debate on Rogan, which I guess by the time this goes up, that'll haven't been, you know, a few months old, but that's really what I am. It's a truth seeker. And, professionally I'm a communicator and storyteller, and, you know, my chief passion, and I think my mission, my purpose in life is health, and to understand why this happened to, you know, a woman who's so vibrant at such a young age. And ultimately she was taken from me. You know, I haven't been public about this. Certainly my mom was around when I wrote my first book, Genius Foods, but I wrote The Genius Life, during a very difficult time. My mom actually, over Labor Day in 2018, after having suffered with this niche form of dementia for 6, 7, 8 years, was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Mm. And, you know, that was just another instance where, you know, you pour your hopes into traditional medicine, hoping that there's going to be a solution. But again, there was nothing for my mom. And from the point of diagnosis, to the point at which she passed away, it was 3 months, and it was just awful. It was horrible. And, you know, one of the, you know, what it really dawned on me at the time was that, you know, nutrition is a major part of this, of living healthily and, you know, and doing the best you can to avert, you know, your risk for these conditions, but it's not the only, piece of the pie. You know, there are other aspects of, living healthily. And that's kind of what, you know, that's sort of like been my new, well, not my new, but the focus for, writing my most recent book.
Yeah, I love it. I think that as we were talking about before we started recording, you were saying we live in a different world. We live in kind of a toxic world, and the nutrition questions are fascinating for both of us. And I completely agree with you that we need to think about things beyond nutrition now as well. And we're going to dig into all that. So let's do it, man.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, like our genes have not changed very much over the past 100, 200, 300 years, right? But the environment has dramatically mutated. It's everything from our lack of exposure to high quality, bright blue light in the morning to too much bright blue light later on in the evening. You know, that's just screwing with our internal clocks. We're now seeing an epidemic of a lack of leisure time physical activity, right? So people are more sedentary than ever before. It's having consequences. We're inundated with environmental pollutants. You know, the occasional exposure here and there might not be that harmful if you're a robust and resilient organism and you're eating foods that are supplying your body's own detox pathways, right? But today, I think the toxicity burden is so high. And we can't possibly have our fingers on the pulses of all the different areas in which life has become so, you know, so difficult from the standpoint of our, you know, biology. But it's just that we're overwhelmed, we're inundated, you know, and it's sort of left us in the dark in terms of our body's detox capabilities. So, you know, one thing that I talk a lot about in the book are, it's our exposure to, you know, compounds in the environment that are potential endocrine disruptors. So I had the privilege to interview a person who heads up the Endocrine Disruption Exchange, which is a really cool organization. You should, you know, I think it's cool to become aware of their work. They're a nonprofit dedicated to spreading the message about the, you know, 1,400 potential endocrine disruptors in our environment that we're exposed to every single day. They range from, you know, bisphenols like BPA. BPA is now being removed from certain products because there's increasing consumer awareness around it. But this has only led to manufacturers pacifying the consumer by replacing BPA with BPS, which is, you know, there's no reason to suspect that BPS is any better for us or any less bad for us, I should say, than BPA. There are phthalates, there are, you know, compounds that are used to create, you know, waterproof textiles and flame retardants in our furniture and things like that. And I think for a long time, people expected these compounds to be inert, to stay put basically in our bottles. But we now know, or on our furniture or in our carpets, but we now know that that these compounds are able to enter the environment. And as a result, they are found in 99% of human beings. And what is that doing to us? You know, what kinds of conditions is that predisposing us to? I mean, some of these chemicals we've been exposed to for our entire lives. I mean, the Environmental Working Group has found 287 industrial compounds in utero, like in the womb, that that a newborn is exposed to. So, I mean, these are chemicals that are just like, they're ubiquitous. They, you know, they can affect development. They can affect the way we feel in the here and now. They can affect our predisposition to various cancers, to weight gain. And so, yeah, I just, you know, I think that my goal with this book is to just kind of like provide information and allow people to become, you know, or to implore people to become just more aware of their environments, you know, more, I think mindfulness is, in many ways can help change like attitudes about the environment. And then I think that's like the most sustainable way to affect behavior. It's just about putting the information forward.
I think knowledge is power. Yeah. Sometimes people say ignorance is bliss, and I would say knowledge is power.
Yeah.
Understanding sure. Where they are, we can start to avoid them. Let's dig into the xenoestrogens a little bit. I did a podcast with Anthony Jay, talked about this some, but the things you're mentioning are a big deal. So BPA, as people will know, is bisphenol A. There's BPS, BPE now as well. So what I do is I just avoid plastics universally.
Yeah.
Do you have any other strategies for avoiding the bisphenol molecules? I guess that's probably the start.
Yeah. I mean, you definitely want to avoid plastics. Also cans. I mean, yes. You know, the thing is I'm not dogmatic about this stuff. And I realize that people live busy lives and that there's a convenience factor associated with some of these products. Like I travel, you know, pretty frequently. And when I'm on the road, if I'm thirsty, I'm going to buy, you know, a plastic bottle. So I'm just going to, full disclosure, like I'm not perfect. Right. But when you buy a plastic bottle filled with water at a, you know, at a convenience store, you have no idea how that plastic bottle has been stored, right? It could have been sitting in a hot cargo bed for months before it reached its final destination, right? Even though you're picking it up from the refrigerator, it could have been sitting in a hot, you know, environment for months, and heat catalyzes the leaching of these plastic compounds into water. And the problem is a compound like BPA, it's been known for almost a century now that it is a xenoestrogen, that it acts in the body like estrogen. It was actually discovered at a time when scientists were looking for a chemical that could mimic the hormone estrogen so that they could give it to women. It could provide relief for problems associated with menopause and menstruation and things like that. I believe it was in the 30s when Charles Edward Dodd was a scientist in the UK. He discovered that this compound that was synthesized in Germany about 30 years prior had profound estrogenic properties. And they were going to fast track it for use in medicine until they discovered another compound called diethyl stilbestrol, or DES. You might have been taught, I don't know if you were taught about DPS in medical
school.
Sure. Yeah, so DES was actually greenlit. It was a much more powerful xenoestrogen, and they started injecting it into millions of women. They also injected it into livestock because it could increase growth and increase milk production and things like that. But it was used in women for decades. They were injecting this stuff into women, and it's basically a sibling to BPA, right? BPA, it was determined, could help create plastic, which was amazing at a time when, you know, plastic really wasn't there, you know, plastic wasn't being mass produced, right? So suddenly plastic became embedded in the American dream, right? There was this new cheap sanitary compound that could withstand breaking and it was heat stable. And suddenly we could fill our homes with any number of, you know, of whatever manufacturers could dream up. Basically, plastic was like this miracle compound. And so BPA went into manufacturing and DES was like, you know, went on the market as a drug. Was approved for use as a drug. Only, you know, a few decades later did they find out that girls that were born to mothers that were injected with DES, they had a dramatically increased risk for cervical or uterine and vaginal cancers. Not cervical cancers, but different cancers of the uterus and the vagina. And so it was like this big nightmare. Suddenly, you know, pharma had to sort of pivot. They ultimately ended up banning DES, but BPA ended up, you know, it stayed in the environment. And I think one of the reasons for that is that we don't expect to ingest this compound. And the dose of BPA that we get is a lot different than being injected with a syringe full of it. But the problem with, compounds that are suspected endocrine disruptors is that they don't follow the typical toxicity, you know, curve, which is the dose makes the poison. One of the problems, I think, with endocrine disruptors, which has made them very hard to not only study, but it's made them tricky to regulate, and obviously manufacturers love this, is that they follow a very unusual sort of toxicity curve. So with most compounds, I mean, a high enough dose of anything becomes toxic, right? Oxygen, water, you drink enough water fast enough, it can kill you. But, and this is certainly true for, you know, compounds, heavy metals, for example, arsenic, that the dose makes the poison. Endocrine disruptors, what makes them so treacherous is that they can have what's called a non-monotonic dose curve. So they might become toxic at a very high dose, but then they could go quiet potentially in the body at sort of a more moderate dose. And then at a very low dose, for whatever reason, they might become actually biologically active. And the problem with these compounds, and I know that you can speak very eloquently to this, is that they affect the way that your hormones work. And hormones, as I mentioned, hormones are involved in everything. They're sort of like the chief marionette strings of the body. They guide development. They guide, you know, your behavior, your thoughts, your feelings, your, you know, your levels of hunger, your predisposition to fat storage. They can affect your rates for certain, your risk for certain cancers, right? On my episode when you were on my podcast, we were talking about certain cancers that are hormone sensitive. And so I think this is super tricky, and treacherous. And, you know, at the end of the day, we're surrounded by compounds made with these chemicals, right? Furniture, utensils that we use to eat, that we store our food in. Whenever you buy anything one of these like healthy supermarkets, you know, that, and you buy a food container that has sort of like a waxy waterproof coating on the interior lining of it so that you can put your food into it and it's not going to bleed through the container.
Yes.
Those are coated with these compounds.
This is like at Whole Foods when you go to the bar.
Yeah. I wasn't going to use the name of the,
yeah.
But
or any grocery store where you're going to the bar and it's brown. So it looks like it's healthy, right? It's a brown cardboard thing. And we don't see, if you look closely, it's got plastic on the inside of it.
Yeah.
That we're putting our eggs and salad or whatever in, it's got plastic on the inside. That's certainly going to interact with our food.
Yeah.
They're lining a lot of things. You said cans.
Cans, these like food receptacles.
Even the Tetra Paks.
Baby bottles, Tetra Paks.
So like, you know, people will buy coconut water or something in Tetra Pak or other types of water. They're all lined with plastic on the inside.
Yeah. So I think it becomes really important to be aware of this so that you can limit your consumption of foods that are, you know, in these kinds of containers. Sous vide cooking. You know, most restaurants actually keep food warm in a sous vide system, which is basically, I love the Weston Price organization's headline on this. Sous vide is a wonderful way to add plastic to your food. You know, it's just crazy. And these compounds, again, you know, like BPA is just one of them, but then we have phthalates. They're known xenoestrogens. They've been known to have an estrogenic effect in the body for decades. So I think being aware of them and knowing where they lurk in the environment so that you can avoid them, I think is crucially important. But then to live your life in a way that encourages your body's own detoxification of them, I think is crucially important as well.
So let's just summarize for people where they are, and then we can talk about the detox.
Yeah.
So for BPA, for the xenoestrogens, we're talking plastics generally. Yeah.
So BPA containers. So the difference between BPA and phthalates, and these are sort of umbrella, you know, phthalates in particular, phthalates make up a huge number of different compounds. And as a rule of thumb, generally, phthalates exist in softer plastics and BPA exists in plastics that are meant to be more hard. So you're going to find BPA usually in hard, bottles, like both in bottles that are sold in, you know, that are like single-use plastics, but then also baby bottles, plastic cutlery, plastic, you know, plates and glasses and cups and mugs and things like that. So you really want to be careful. They're used in, I mean, to produce CDs and things like that, furniture. Phthalates are used to make plastic sort of more soft. They're also used in fragrances. So you really want to avoid, anytime you see like fragrance on a product that you're, you know, either inhaling or, like compounds that you spray on your furniture or air fresheners or things like that. These are all made with phthalates, basically. And you know, the thing about fragrances, when you see those on a label, I mean, those could, you know, the singular word fragrance could represent hundreds of different, you know, distinct chemicals in that product. So you really want to be cautious of using anything fragranced. If you do want to, you know, use something that's fragrance, I mean, you really want them to be primarily plant-based, you know, essential oils and things like that. So generally avoiding plastic. Also, BPA is super concentrated on store receipts.
Right.
Store receipts.
The thermographic.
Major access point of exposure. We don't eat store receipts, obviously, but there's a strong chance that these compounds are going to make their way. You know, I mean, humans, we have a lot of hand-to-mouth behavior, whether or not we'll acknowledge it or recognize it even. But you don't want to be handling these store receipts, especially if you're younger, because, you know, again, hormones can affect development.
There's something I've even seen that some of these checkers at the grocery stores who are handling them all day are exposed even more to a very high degree.
To a super high degree.
Yeah. When they try to hand me them, I'm like, no, I don't want it. Don't even hand it to me.
Yeah, generally I'll say that too. And sometimes I feel compelled to let them know that they should be wearing gloves.
You should wear gloves.
Yeah, you should wear gloves.
I don't know if they would.
Yeah, you can always tell when the receipt is, has this BPA coating on it because you can, well, not that I want you to start touching your receipts to do this, but you can actually write on them with your fingernails. Right. They're heat sensitive. So it's the friction that creates the, you know, the quote unquote ink that's, you know, that's on these receipts. And then anything that's used to make, fabrics waterproof or non-stick, you know, so like non-stick pans, you want to avoid those. They use compounds that are also, you know, endocrine disruptors.
And there are a lot of permutations of this.
Ton.
There's PTFE, there's Teflon, and these companies continue to reinvent nonstick and they call it ceramic when it's not really.
Yeah.
I think we need to be very careful of these nonstick things and I avoid them exclusively. Do you as well?
Yeah. I do. I mean, there's a great movie actually that came out recently called Dark Waters, where they show that PFOA, which is one of the compounds used to make Teflon, for a long time wasn't regulated, and a huge, you know, multinational conglomerate, DuPont, along with 3M, they were just like pumping, you know, products out using this stuff, because a nonstick pan to make eggs with back when nonstick pans first came out, I mean, that was like a dream for anybody, you know, who was a homebody, you know, to have a pan that like you can cook eggs on and it wouldn't stick. They started pumping the stuff into the water of these like local communities where the DuPont factories were, where they were making this stuff. The people that were exposed to them in the factories were developing all kinds of, you know, their offspring had all kinds of birth defects. And they were just not forthright about even the own internal science that they were doing and publishing in-house. They were just like pumping this stuff out into the world. And, you know, it was just a huge problem. So needless to say, the approach that I think people should take with these kinds of newfangled miracle chemicals, convenience chemicals, is that they should be considered guilty until proven innocent. I think too frequently we consider them innocent until proven guilty, you know, maybe because we like the convenience that they offer to our lives, but there's no such thing as a free lunch, you know, at the end of the day. So when I cook, I use stainless steel, as you can see. I mean, we're in my kitchen right now. I've got a stainless steel pot over there that I use. I use cast iron to cook foods like steak and eggs. Although, you know, even a cast iron pan, I think, and I'd love your thoughts on this, but as a male, and I don't practice phlebotomy very often, you know, I don't give blood as frequently as I would like. A cast iron pan adds a significant amount of iron to your food. Yeah. And so
do you know what your ferritin is?
I actually don't off the top of my head, but yeah, it's not, you know, iron's the kind of thing where you don't want to accumulate too much of it. It's sort of like a Goldilocks thing. I know that we've talked about this, but, if you're going to get your iron, I think you should get it from food, not necessarily your cooking utensils.
No, I agree. In my book, I recommend it against cast iron for that reason. I think it's going to add too much iron to the food.
Yeah,
we could just check our iron. And if we're doing that carefully, perhaps it's not a big deal. I wonder about the chemistry of an iron pan affecting the meat in a certain way as well. I haven't seen any studies on this, but I do have concerns about it. So yeah, I use a stainless steel pan as well to cook my steaks kind of gently. We were talking about this in the previous podcast we recorded. How do we cook food?
Yeah.
And I think that it's both what we cook the food in and how we cook the food. You mentioned sous vide. I agree that we probably don't want to use sous vide with the regular polyethylene bags. Perhaps the silicone bags are better, but those they do make phthalate-free silicone bags. But again, it's like, what do we do there, right? I think the lower temperature is good. The water bath kicking is good, but putting it in any sort of plastic makes me wonder. And then we've talked about the nonstick stuff is hard. I just end up with like low temperature, gradual cooking in a pan or cooking it in like a steam convection oven. But I think we have to be careful with cast iron and people should check their ferritin.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like, it's about, you know, there's really no, you know, one size fits all recommendation. I'm, you know, assuming you don't have a lot of vegans or vegetarians listening to your podcast, but I mean, you know, I try to be inclusive of all different sort of dietary philosophies.
Me too.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Yeah. And so, you know, if you're not getting adequate iron in your diet, I mean, using a cast iron pan as actually a way to increase the iron, you know, contents of your diet. I'll use it generally if I'm making a steak or something like really high heat. I just don't have a lot of personal experience with stainless steel enough to be confident that I could make like a steak in it, for example. But yeah, so I mean, I think that's super important. I talk about different, you know, like aluminum, I think is, you know, I'm not going to say that aluminum, you know, tin foil is unsafe, but, you know, these kinds of things do add, you know.
Exactly. It gets in your food.
Aluminum does get into your food.
I avoid it.
Yeah. And again, you know, I try not to be like fear-mongering, you know, it's not, there's just no way to avoid all potential exposure. I mean, we could talk about air pollution a little bit, but, you know, the modern, I think if you're able to reduce the burden a little bit, your body does have, you know, profound detox capabilities. You just want to be able to support your body in the best way possible and try to minimize the burden a little bit. And I think you'll be okay.
How do we detox? How do we sort of support that system?
I mean, I definitely think that, you know, exercise is powerfully, you know, detoxifying, sweating in general. So I'm a huge fan of saunas. I think it's no surprise that you look at, you know, there's a bunch of observational studies now that are coming out of the University of Eastern Finland, which are great because they look at the use of saunas. Finland is the sauna capital of the world. And so I think some of the, you know, if you were to do a study like some of the studies that are coming out of the University of Eastern Finland in the U.S., there would be a very strong healthy user bias, right? Like people who have saunas in the U.S. or have access to saunas in the U.S., you know, probably have gym memberships. They're spending a lot of time in spas and things like that. But in Finland, a sauna is like taking a bath, you know, like saunas. There's some crazy statistic, but there's generally, there's one sauna per house in Finland. Like they have them in their homes. And so I think it's a really good place to do these kinds of studies to see how saunas, you know, relate to health outcomes. And they're seeing dramatically reduced risks for, you know, stroke, cardiovascular disease, all-cause dementia, Alzheimer's disease, things like that, with people who use saunas more frequently. There's like a dose response. So you are able to purge many of these compounds through your sweat. The skin is a major detox organ. And whether we're talking about phthalates, BPA, heavy metals like mercury, aluminum, things like that, they come out in the sweat. So I think when it comes to detoxification, I mean, you definitely want to make sure that you are doing things regularly that lead to your sweating. And I know that some people don't sweat very much when they exercise. You know, for me, I go to the gym and I can have a great workout. And, you know, there are times when I feel like I've really exhausted my energy levels, yet I haven't sweat. And so I make an effort to sort of stimulate sweating as best I can, whether it's through saunas or even working out sometimes in a sweater, which I'll do, or like a hoodie, you know. I know. So
ugly sweater in the gym. You have a Christmas ugly sweater.
No, not a Christmas. No, like a hoodie. I'll just bring a hoodie. I was talking to Kyle Kingsbury. Do you know him?
Sure. Yeah. I'm actually hanging out with him this week.
Nice. He's a great guy. Yeah. We were talking about, he was on my show and he was saying, you know, that's where I got the idea from, actually, that he'll sometimes, like, even on a hot day in Austin, which is where he lives, he'll put on a sweater and he'll, like, you know, do a few laps around the block or something like that. Because if you don't have access to a sauna, like, what do you do, right? You can actually impose heat stress on yourself and get yourself to sweat some of this stuff out. And I think it's crucial. And just, you know, as a caveat, it's not, doing so is not without risk, you know, so you want to be careful if you're...
Don't overheat. Extra salt.
Extra salt. Yeah. Drink a little more water.
Yeah.
Electrolytes, important.
Yeah. I think for detoxification, we just have to make sure we're peeing and pooping and sweating.
Peeing and pooping and sweating. Yeah.
Peeing and pooping and sweating. And if we're constipated, man, I mean, pooping, the enteroendocrine recirculation of things happens and we need to make sure we're pooping. And if we're not pooping, one of our major detoxification mechanisms is not there. I mean, urine is a good thing and we can probably even get a little bit out through the breath, but sweating regularly, yeah, good idea. Some metals come out in sweat, not all of them do, but definitely I think that's, if we're doing those things, and then we could talk about supporting glutathione and segue to glycine a little bit, and then we can maybe circle back to some of those or environmental hormetics.
Yeah. So, I mean, supporting glutathione production, you know, obviously those sulfur-containing amino acids, consuming adequate...
Cysteine.
Meat. I'm a fan. I do whey protein. I do it not because I feel like you need that to support glutathione synthesis, but I do it just to reach, you know, I talk a bit about, protein in the book and how important getting adequate protein is. And so I use a whey protein supplement, and whey protein is pretty high in cysteine. I feel like there have even been a few studies that have shown that whey protein can, can boost glutathione.
Boosts
intracellular glutathione.
Yeah, there definitely are studies with that. I think for people who are not sensitive to dairy or whey, it can be a good option.
Yeah, where does that fall in the carnivore spectrum?
I mean, so in terms of carnivore thinking, dairy's great. It's just, I can't do it. I've tried multiple times. Yeah. I've done raw goat's milk multiple times, A1, A2. I'm just immunologically triggered by either casein or whey or both. So it returns my eczema. I get itchiness. I'm just like, it just doesn't work for me. And so, but I think for people who can tolerate it, it can be a good thing as long as we're aware of the quality.
Yeah.
I would select an A2 variant perhaps of the casein rather than an A1 variant. But yeah, I think whey protein milk is very nutritious, and for people that can tolerate it, a whey protein might be a good option for that. It's the, we were talking about a little bit before the show, glycine is important. So glutathione is you know, cysteine, glutamine, and glycine. And there's a supplement, N-acetylcysteine, which kind of bypasses one of the rate limiting steps for glutathione synthesis by giving, you know, the acetyl group on the cysteine. And I think there's something about the cysteine in milk. And this has actually been studied in egg whites as well, though I'm not an advocate of doing egg whites, raw egg whites too much, because you can deplete your biotin with the avidin.
Binds biotin, right?
Yeah. But raw egg whites and whey protein have been studied, and there's a variant of cysteine, I believe, in these that's been shown to increase glutathione. Not the only way, but it's one way.
Yeah, so I'm a big advocate of, you know, consuming properly raised meat for that purpose. I also, you know, I mean, I'm a big personally, I eat plants. I like to consume dark leafy greens, cruciferous vegetables, things like that. I mean, I feel that when a person is exposed to, you know, environmental pollutants, it's good to do whatever you can to upregulate, the synthesis of these compounds, and, you know, glutathione obviously being one of them. Glycine I became really interested in. I mean, I definitely am a fan. I've been a fan of collagen for a while, but I've had enough conversations with Chris Masterjohn where it caused me to really do a deep dive into the role of glycine in detoxification. And, you know, obviously the more muscle meat you consume, the more methionine you're ingesting, and you need that glycine to buffer methionine. And I like to say that I'm eating, you know, organ meats every day, but the truth is I'm not. I supplement with collagen protein as well. But if you're not getting adequate amounts of glycine, which is, as you mentioned, rate limiting in the synthesis of glutathione, I think it becomes important to go out of your way to get more glycine in your diet. There have been a number of studies showing that glycine can actually improve sleep, which I think is, obviously useful. But in terms of the synthesis of glutathione, so I'll integrate, glycine, whether it's through collagen or just a standalone glycine supplement, which I'll skip obviously when I'm eating more organ meats and things like that. Also, the consumption of fiber, dark leafy greens, as you mentioned, pooping out some of these contaminants. When you consume a higher mineral load in your diet, that actually is able to reduce the absorption of, heavy metals that you don't want, like mercury, arsenic, things like that. So, I'm always going out of my way. I think the onus is really on us to opt for nutrient dense foods that are going to help to, not only supply the precursor molecules for these detoxification compounds, but also to stimulate them. And then, they help you to absorb less in the gut. There are also some, strains of gut bacteria that can help. I forget, exactly which, but, cultivating gut bacterial diversity, I think, is a good way to sort of buffer again, against the absorption of some of these compounds, that we don't want. It's about eating a well-rounded diet, I think, that, focuses on animal protein, properly raised, red meat, ideally organ meats if you're going to get that, but then also incorporate some of these, this plant matter, which I know that you're not a fan of. Every time I want to bring up plants, I feel like I kind of like lower my voice a little bit.
You can bring up plants. Yeah. We can talk about it. I think that we agree on most of this. I think the key is having a lot of glutathione, yeah, right? And glutathione is not the only antioxidant in the human body. There are other systems involved, but glutathione is one of the major ones, right? And it's pretty clear we want enough glutathione. I've talked about this with Chris Masterjohn. The problem is there's no good test. If we could just, maybe in the future, we'll be able to measure glutathione, but glutathione is two states, oxidized and reduced. What you really want to know is how much is oxidized, how much is reduced, and your overall. You want to have enough, you want to be making enough, you want to make sure, and the oxidized to reduced ratio might give you a sense of your oxidative stress and how much is being used to quell the blaze, right? And so we talked about some strategies to get enough. Interestingly, red meat has glutathione, so I don't think it's ever been studied, how much of a glutathione supplement red meat may be in the human diet, and I've posted studies on my website showing that grass-fed meat, like stuff from like Belcampo or White Oak Pastures, actually has more glutathione. And so I'm quite curious about, and I suspect that we can get a decent amount of glutathione just from meat, and that may improve it. And I think that a lot of what Chris and I wonder about and differ slightly on opinion about regarding glutathione status in a ketogenic diet versus a carnivore ketogenic diet or a low-level ketogenic diet versus with carbohydrates and insulin signaling could probably be sorted out if we could measure glutathione more easily. But I think Chris's opinion would be that with carbohydrates, we get this insulin signal, and that may lead to more glutathione. My counter argument would be that we can get lots of insulin signaling with lower levels of insulin when we're insulin sensitive, and that when we're getting plenty of precursors, I'm not convinced clinically or scientifically that I've seen evidence that our glutathione levels drop when we don't eat carbohydrates. But regardless, we want to have lots of glutathione to do all this work, because glutathione is involved in detoxification of metals and all this other stuff. And that's how we detoxify most of the stuff. Like when we get a mercury load, if I see somebody with a mercury load, I'm going to give them glutathione for a short amount of time because it's going to use it up. So yeah, however we can get that. And so we could do whey protein if we're dairy intolerant, or we could do lots of meat to get the building blocks, thinking about organ meats and or connective tissue for glycine and or collagen and or glycine specifically. But yeah, the methionine glycine ratio is important there.
Yeah.
We want to have enough of that for sure. And that's, I think that we just need to figure out, maybe somebody will just develop a test. We need an easily accessible test for glutathione. It seems like it would tell us so much.
Yeah, that would be awesome. Another great source of dietary glutathione are mushrooms, especially porcini mushrooms. I don't know where mushrooms fall on the spectrum because they're not plants. Do that, but I mean, have you looked into mushrooms and whether or not they have the defense compounds that
they often do? Yeah, like white and button mushrooms have agaricin, the agaricus species, and that's toxic. Most of it's degraded when you cook, but they still do develop because they're not sedentary. It's not the word for mushrooms. They're rooted in the ground. But yeah, I wonder. Porcini mushrooms have glutathione, huh?
Yeah, glutathione, ergothionine. They were the
right ergothionine.
Yeah, they're the top. They were the top in the study that I think really kind of brought this into the fold. Porcini mushrooms were the top. They had the highest concentration.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I'm open to the fact that some of these foods may be beneficial.
There's interesting research in Asia now. They're doing some studies, I believe in China, where they're finding that, you know, I mean, it all starts with like epidemiology and these observational studies, right? They help generate hypotheses. They're finding that people who consume more mushrooms tend to have reduced risks of various types of dementia or cognitive impairment, I should say, dementia and mild cognitive impairment, which is sort of like a prodrome to more serious forms of cognitive impairment. So, I'm a fan of mushrooms.
People ask me about mushrooms all the time.
Do they?
Yeah. I wrote a little bit about it in the book, and I generally was kind of like, yeah, I'm not sure. You know, I would not. I have to think, is porcini in the same family as cremini and white button mushrooms? Because all of the agaricus species of mushrooms have agaricin, which is toxic, and you want to make sure you cook them a lot. So there is a toxin in like white button mushrooms, cremini, portobello, all of those. And I think porcini might be, I don't know, maybe it's a different family. I've been trying to get a mycologist on my show. I want to get like Paul Stamets or something.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
Kind of dig into it all, but I don't think we know enough. Some mushrooms like lion's mane appear to have benefit. And then again, I think back to the plant kind of paradigm or the plant construct that I've suggested in the past. Like, does the benefit outweigh the risk? Are they going to have toxins that are going to affect us in negative ways? Are these benefits something that we can achieve in other ways, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the fungi kingdom is interesting because it's just as wide and diverse as the plant and animal kingdom. And many of our actual, you know, medicines we get from mushrooms, which just goes to show you, if nothing else, that they have, you know, biological activity.
Oh yeah.
In us, you know, obviously some are extremely poisonous, but I'm, you know, open to the idea that some could be beneficial as well. I have a lot of, friends, people in my life who are big believers in, you know, quote unquote medicinal mushrooms, lion's mane, reishi, chaga, cordyceps, things like that. And the science is really sparse, but
some of them are pretty high in oxalate. I know chaga has a decent amount of oxalate.
Really?
Yeah. In the book, I talk about one specific case study. A woman developed kidney failure on chaga. Mm. She was doing a lot, like 4 tablespoons a day, but not out of the realm of what's done today. Mm. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I think that those are, you know, whether or not you choose to incorporate shrooms, you know, they're all super, I think, important ways of, reducing the toxic burden. Exercise, making sure you're exercising, sleeping well. Sleep is crucially important, and not sort of interfering with the body's sort of winding down processes at the end of the day is another, you know, topic that I talk a lot about in the book. You know, melatonin, for example, is a hormone that's involved in getting us sleepy, helping us wind down, but it's also a detox hormone, you know, and so many of us are living lives where our faces are just plugged into our screens 24/7, and it's causing this, you know, this significant suppression of the release of that hormone. They've done a number of interesting studies where they've actually given people with type 2 diabetes, you know, who have rampant oxidative stress in their bodies, supplemental melatonin, and they find that melatonin is able to reduce markers of inflammation, oxidative stress, and even, I believe, improve markers of insulin sensitivity. So, I mean, it's a really powerful hormone involved in, you know, in good health. And I think is we owe some of the restorative benefits of sleep, obviously, to melatonin. But so many of us today are, you know, we're just suppressing it with our overexposure to blue light. So in a way, you can almost consider blue light a toxin of sorts and, oh, yeah. and an impingement on our body's ability to properly detox.
And I think that there's an antagonistic relationship between insulin and melatonin, which is kind of could lead us into the circadian stuff. I've heard it discussed, though I haven't gone deeply down the rabbit hole, that perhaps eating late could inhibit the formation of melatonin or the release of melatonin, because I believe there's evidence that insulin and melatonin are antagonistic. And so that if you eat late at night, you're kind of changing your body's clock, right? I've talked about this a little bit in the past on previous podcasts, this time-restricted eating and where the window is best. Let's dig into that a little bit. But I think that the research suggests that if you eat late at night and there's an insulin spike, even if, no matter what you're eating, there's going to be more insulin. Even if you're eating a carnivore diet or a ketogenic diet, there is a postprandial bump in insulin, not as much as with a carbohydrate meal. But I think that that may negatively affect the release of melatonin from the brain.
Well, they are. They've actually done randomized. There was a randomized controlled trial that I talk about in the book where they gave people melatonin supplements in the morning. So in the morning, for all intents and purposes, melatonin is supposed to be the lowest that it's going to be throughout the day. And having high melatonin levels in the morning actually can induce insulin resistance. So it's one of the reasons why, you know, there's this notion of afternoon diabetes, that we become less insulin sensitive as the day goes on. Because during the day, your body is primed to, you know, to support daylight associated activity. And that's, you know, certainly true from a hormonal standpoint, from the standpoint of your neurotransmitters. But food is a major time setter in the body. The primary time setter in the body is light. And so that's why it's really important to get out, first thing in the morning when you wake up, you know, before noon. I think it's crucially important to allow bright blue light from the sun or even on an overcast day to enter your eyeballs. We have a protein in the eye called melanopsin, which is not involved in the formation of vision, but it's there chiefly to sort of communicate with tiny chocolate chip sized region of the brain called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is housed in the hypothalamus, which is a sort of very primitive ancient region of the brain involved in everything from hunger to our drive for sex, and things like that. It's been there for a very long time. And these proteins in the eye, the melanopsin proteins, they're only sensitive to bright light. So they're not sensitive to, they're not going to get, you know, switched off from the light that comes from, a campfire or stars in the sky or a moon, but it takes about 1,000 lux of light to basically flip that switch that tells your brain that it's daytime. And I think that, you know, with 92% of the time that we're now spending is being spent indoors, we're seeing just a lot of circadian disruption. We're seeing a lot of people just fatigued and lethargic over the course of the day. And I think that, you know, the fact that we're not getting this bright light in to really shut off the production of melatonin could play a role in the fact, you know, that so many people are now insulin resistant. Obviously, there are myriad variables that are related to the epidemic of insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes and the like. But one of the recommendations that I make, I think it's crucially important to get in that bright light during the day. And so, you know, setting our body's clock is pretty important, but I think, you know, maintaining its rhythm has become one of the central challenges of modern life. And that's because at the end of the day, you can easily enter, there are myriad contexts in the modern world where we're inundated with light at an intensity of about 1,000 lux, which is what it takes to set off those melanopsin proteins. So if you enter your average, CVS pharmacy or Whole Foods or even gym, the light intensity in those environments can often reach 1,000 lux, which, you know, if you're doing that later on in the day, it's telling your brain essentially that it's morning. And so what that's going to do is that's going to hinder melatonin production at a time of day where you really want it to ramp up so that you can have some of those detoxifying, you know, regenerative effects. And then of course, melatonin is involved in sleep. So, you know, it's crucial. Sleep is very important when it comes to, you know, the brain's detoxification, among other things, your brain, we now know, is cleaning itself, you know, during the time in which we're sleeping, thanks to the newly discovered glymphatic system. You know, proteins like amyloid and tau, these proteins are flushed out when we go to sleep. And so, you know, anything that we can do to encourage and not detract from good quality sleep, I think is going to be important.
Yeah, that antagonistic relationship between melatonin and insulin is quite interesting. And the fact that people got insulin resistant when they got melatonin in the morning, and then I think the reverse, like if we're eating late at night, it could throw it off and you might not get as much melatonin. In my place, I have red lights. So like at night, the whole place is red.
I like that.
I can only imagine what people on the street think.
Yeah.
It's like a rave.
Or like a brothel of some sort.
I know,
sort.
Right?
Like, you're running like some...
Yeah, like shady stuff. But I feel like an old man, but I often am hesitant to leave the house at night. I don't want to go to CVS. I don't want to go to the grocery store. I don't want to go to the gym at 7 o'clock at night. It's just bright. Yeah. Interrupts things.
Yeah. It's hard to avoid, you know, I wish that I could live this sort of perfect life. Right. But my brother lives in a building where, and I hang out with my brother a lot. He recently moved to LA, where the elevator to get up into his apartment is just so bright in terms of like the fluorescent light. And I actually there's an app that you can download for your phone. I believe it's called Flux. I don't think it's perfectly accurate, but, it's good to have on your phone because you can get a sense of, like, you know, if you frequent certain environments to get a sense of the light intensity there. The elevator that I use to get in and out of my brother's apartment, which sometimes I'm in, you know, late at night, the light intensity can easily reach 1,000 lux. And so I don't know what to do. You know, it's like, I think that's a common problem for people, that we're inundated with this artificial light, and it's problematic. So one of the things that I do, rather than, you know, because I don't think the ideal is to become a hermit to your red light, you know, to your to your home, and to become slave to your
agreed
become a slave to your red lights. But you know, I'm a big fan of blue blocking glasses, which, you know, of all the sort of gimmicks in the biohacking health and wellness world these days, I think that blue light, having a good pair of blue blockers is crucially important, you know, both for, you know, being in your home and being able to work late at night if you choose to on your computer, to watching TV, or even being out and about in the real world. I think being able to have some sort of level of filter between your eyes, those melanopsin proteins, and the blue light that we're exposed to, important.
Yeah. And so we're talking here about both intensity of the light and the wavelengths.
Yeah.
The blue wavelengths uniquely sort of trigger the suprachiasmatic nucleus, or send information to the suprachiasmatic nucleus to not secrete melatonin. And the intensity of the light can be another thing. So you'd ideally, it sounds like you would want sort of darkened blue blocking glasses, and most of them are kind of darkening as well. Hopefully they would address both the intensity and the wavelengths.
Yeah. I've got two pairs. I've got one pair that's really dark. But to be honest, I don't wear that pair as much because it's hard to read, first of all. So I feel like I strain my eyes when I'm like trying to read through those glasses. I try to, the recommendations that I make, I try to, you know, cater them to people who are not going to want to become obsessed with this stuff, but that are going to want to, I mean, I provide those recommendations too for optimal, but then I also think it's good to kind of acknowledge the fact that, people are living in the real world and people have obligations, whether it's socially or professionally. Yeah. And my experience, you know, I've been really lucky in that I've gotten to do some of these like huge health TV shows, like the Dr. Oz show. We were talking about the doctors earlier, you know, and I'm always cognizant of sort of the audience that I'm talking to and the audience that I want to talk to, people that are like really far out there in terms of their, you know, the knowledge that they have about health, and making my recommendations as sort of approachable and accessible as they can be.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it. I think it's important. It's definitely a different audience. I think that the podcast audience, pretty sharp, pretty astute, and, maybe a little bit different audience on the doctors and Dr. Oz and kind of basic stuff. Definitely when I won the doctors, I'm not sure that the audience was ready for the carnivore diet, nor were the doctors.
Well, I think it's important. I think it's important to have both of those conversations. Like I like having both of those conversations. I like to be as diligent in my own life as I can be, but you know, like I travel a lot and you know, like I think that living a genius life, as I like to call it, involves, you know, social outings and occasions where you're not going to be in full control. And so you got to be able to do the best you can. I mean, I'm not ever going to restaurants, for example, and throwing caution to the wind and ordering like fried food or anything like that. I'm not doing that. But I think it's good to kind of know where, you know, where the areas in life are that you can make compromises that that are going to still allow for you to be getting the biggest bang for your buck in terms of health and you know, sort of like the low-hanging fruit. It's sort of like a triage approach, you know, in terms of the things that are going to have the most meaningful and measurable impact on your health. And so just becoming cognizant of the fact that blue light can be a toxin essentially, at a certain point in the day. And it's actually almost like a vitamin at other points in the day, I think is a really, powerful insight for people who are not privy to this stuff.
Yeah. I think that in the book, I talk about the quality of life equation and this idea that what you are doing, what I'm doing is just trying to add value to people's lives and increase the quality. And so ultimately we're solving for quality of life at any moment. And for most of us, the majority of the time, that quality of life is going to be feeling good, performing good athletically. But for sometimes the highest quality of life is going with your friends at 10 o'clock at night to a bar and having a drink. And that's okay. That's your highest quality of life at that moment. And you act accordingly. And we sort of know that it doesn't always have to be a carnivore diet or the strictest diet that we can imagine or the perfect light setting. We have the knowledge which empowers us to make those decisions as best we can when we're solving for that other higher quality of life in different situations. But sometimes the highest quality of life I've, you know, is having a piece of birthday cake and at your kid's birthday, maybe.
Maybe half, for you. Half. Yeah.
Not me.
I avoid that stuff. I mean, I'm pretty rigorous in terms of my diet. You know, but like if I'm traveling and I'm at an airport and I don't have my blue light blockers on me, am I going to freak out about the fact that it's, yeah, no. So that's pretty much it. But I think in the areas where you can, you know, have control, I think that you should be, you know, as rigorous, you know, as, you know, what do they say? Halfway measures lead to halfway results. So I think at the end of the day, if you can be diligent and go all in, then do that, you know?
Yeah.
But there are some people, plenty of people, lots of people, most people out there that are still, you know, drinking fruit juice because they think it's good for them, you know?
Yeah.
So
one of the later chapters in your book is called Peace of Mind. Maybe this is a good segue.
Yeah.
What's that one about?
So that's sort of my attempt to kind of distill everything that we know, about just what it means to, live a life that incorporates, you know, the aspects of the modern world that are not so much like, you know, toxins from the standpoint of light and biology, but from more of like a mental health perspective. So I talk, a little bit about the latest research on psychedelics and what they can potentially offer to our mental health. Not that I'm a big advocate for psychedelic use, but I do think that the research coming out of, Hopkins and NYU is very interesting in terms of, you know, just a better understanding of where some of these, you know, issues that many people are now struggling with, like anxiety and depression, are coming from. I talk a little bit about our overuse of technology and how to develop a healthier relationship with social media, which I think is important. They've done a number of studies where they found that people who limit their social media consumption, no surprise, or, you know, they have less stress and they feel more connected to people, even though social media gives us this sort of false sense of connection. So it's sort of like it's a closing chapter in the book where I try to sort of tie a bow on all of the other aspects of life that I think make it meaningful. Everything from avoiding, you know, noise pollution to philosophies that my mom actually, you know, instilled in me that I think helped to make me the person who I am. So it's sort of an interesting chapter. It goes sort of, it covers a lot of ground, but, you know, living a genius life is not all nutrition. It's not all exercise, and it's not all, you know, getting light and avoiding blue light. It's sometimes about, you know, just sort of mindset and all that. So that's kind of where I go in that chapter.
I like it.
Yeah.
What are some of those philosophies from your mom?
Yeah. Well, you know, my mom always raised me with I think she raised me with a pretty strong moral compass. She was a big, and I learned a lot from her and the life that she led. For one, she, you know, she raised me to be truthful. In my house growing up, being a liar was like the worst thing that anybody could call, you know, one another. And so I think that that's one of the reasons why I've ended up going down the trajectory that I've gone down professionally, you know, as sort of this perennial truth seeker of sorts. It's that I think honesty is crucially important. And today, you know, we live in a time where it's hard to parse fact from fiction. You know, there's so much spin, whether it comes from the world of politics or the world of nutrition. I think, you know, there's a lot of dishonesty. And I think in your own personal life, if you're able to be more honest with other people and with yourself, I think that you're gonna be a lot better off in terms of your mental health, in terms of your just your overall happiness quotient. My mom was a big animal rights advocate, and animal rights, you know, matter a lot to me. But I think that my mom lived much of her life, you know, as you know, attempting to be a bit of a martyr for animals. And, you know, in terms of my nutritional philosophy, you know, it's been shaped in many ways by the fact that my mom was a, you know, that my mom was a big abstainer of eating animal products for the majority of her life. And I think that that's one of the major, you know, I'll never know with any certainty, and I want to, you know, I don't want to go beyond what I'm able to say about it, but, you know, I think that the avoidance of animal products for my mom was a major problem for her in terms of her health. And I think, you know, my hypothesis is that if she were to have incorporated more, that she would have been better off. Growing up, you know, it's not like I was looking all that closely with what my mom ate, but over the years, you know, I certainly know that my mom never ate any red meat. When she did eat meat, it was only for the protein, quote unquote, and it was always lean chicken breast, you know, never with any skin on, and fish and things like that. And my mom never believed in organic or anything like that. And she was, you know, we were privileged. We grew up in New York City. We were, you know, somewhat affluent in that my mom, if she wanted to buy organic, she could. But, you know, back then there was no grass-fed, you know, animal, like there, that just wasn't an option, you know, and she didn't believe in organic. So she ate basically lean protein, you know, on occasion, but the majority of her diet was based upon low fat and fat free grain products and non-organic vegetables. She was always, the irony was that she was always afraid of developing heart disease because that's what her father passed from. And she never, you know, her heart health, as far as I know, was pristine. She ended up obviously developing dementia and pancreatic cancer. But so she was always attuned to messaging surrounding heart health and what it meant to eat a heart healthy diet in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And so we always had margarine around my house growing up. We had, you know, oh my God, corn oil always by the stove, sitting in that big plastic jug, you know, just accumulating heat, damaging the oil,
BPAs,
allowing the BPA to enter that oil. And that's what we cooked with growing up. And so I do think that that played a big role. And my mom was, you know, she didn't eat meat because she cared too much about animals. She also never ate eggs. That's the other thing. She was always very afraid of the cholesterol in the egg yolks because of, you know, for heart health reasons. So she was very, I mean, her diet was very vegetarian, you know, with the exception of the occasional lean protein because, you know, because she knew that she needed protein. But I do think that that was, I mean, what I can say is that that diet certainly didn't help her. And that was, that diet was sort of the, you know, a nutritionist's or a dietitian's dream of that time, right?
The consensus.
Yeah, it was the consensus. Avoiding fat, you know, avoiding saturated fat, avoiding dietary cholesterol, loading up on grain products. And she did it mostly because of her love for animals. And so I applaud people who, you know, who believe that eating that way for the betterment of, you know, because it's maybe, you know, in their view, the kinder approach for animals and then walking that walk, you know, I think that that's certainly commendable, but we could even debate whether or not that's a better option for the animals, you know, and, we know that the industrial, I mean, my stance is industrial agriculture, you know, if you're partaking in that system, there's blood on everybody's hands, you know. So by not, you know, by avoiding to not eat the singular cow, you know, which could feed your family for months, right? One single cow, that's one life. You know, how many, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, if not millions of rodents are you decapitating by supporting the industrial agriculture complex? So I don't think that there's, I think that the kindest system, when it comes to animals, and certainly when it comes to yourself, and it comes to, you know, the health of your loved ones, and just sort of being able to be there for your loved ones, is eating in whichever diet is going to make you the healthiest. And that's, you know, so that's become my stance. So that's what I've learned. That's one of the things that I've learned from my mom, even though that wasn't her, you know, explicit teaching. But I've, you know, that's one of the more powerful lessons that my mom has left me with.
I think we owe that to ourselves,
yeah,
to understand what diet is going to make us healthy. And to do that, we've all been gifted a human life and we have the ability to do things with it. And if we are not healthy, how can we do anything with our life? Whether it's caring for our children, being good partners for our spouses, contributing creativity and ideas to the world, being kind to people in the street. Like if we do not understand how to be healthy humans and respect that that's an okay choice to make, whatever sort of food we just choose to eat doing that, we're kind of, I think we're not going to get off out of square one. Like we've got to do that. I mean, we have to be healthy in order to do our work in the world. And I believe that that's mostly or entirely animal-based diet. I think that you're pretty close, you know, with the addition of some plants, certainly animal-centric,
yeah,
for you. So I think that this is what we do. And I've had this discussion a few times with people. There's a great book that I read growing up by Tom Brown called The Tracker. And in it, there's a character called Grandfather. This is a nonfiction book about Tom Brown's childhood, kind of apprentice to an Apache Indian in northeastern New Jersey or northwestern New Jersey when he was growing up a couple decades ago. But you know, this Apache Indian told him, in order for something to live, something else must die. And that's just the way of life. And it's not cruel. That's just what we do. And people who choose not to eat animals but are participating in industrial agriculture, which is almost a requirement these days, like you said, there's still a cost to that.
A huge cost. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Again, you can, I mean, I don't hunt, but if you were to, you know, to go hunting and kill an animal to feed your family, that animal could feed your family potentially, depending on what animal it is, for a very long time. And that's, you know, I mean, if we're going to quantify lives, I mean, I don't know how to quantify
this
stuff.
How do we even do that, right?
How do we even do that? Right, right. Exactly.
Earthworms.
Yeah.
It's ants.
It's impossible to do. So, I mean, that's where I think, yeah, it's to include animals because of their nutritional benefits. You know, all I'll say is that my mom made a very low animal protein diet. She occasionally would eat, and again, I just want to, this is an N of one anecdote. So I'm not, you know, I don't base my research around, you know, just sort of N of one experience that I've had with my mom, but she had a low animal protein diet, and, you know, did not care very much about organic or anything like that. And, it was low in saturated fat. It was low in cholesterol and her health was, I mean, horrible. And I wouldn't wish the health that she had on anybody. So
clearly I don't think that's not the answer. Right. Yeah. And I said the word consensus when you were saying that, because we are recording this after a recent thing on Joe Rogan with James Wilkes and, yeah, Chris Kresser, and James Wilkes consistently said, Chris Kresser is not following consensus evidence. And I couldn't believe he was saying that and that Joe wasn't calling him on it. Like, who cares about the consensus evidence? The consensus evidence when your mom was younger was low fat canola oil. The consensus evidence in the 1930s was diethylstilbestrol.
Yeah.
The consensus evidence 30,000 years ago or 100,000 years ago was putting holes in people's skulls to release spirits, right?
Oh, God.
And the consensus evidence 200 years ago was leeches and bloodletting. So how can we even begin to say including animals in your diet is not the consensus evidence, therefore you're ignoring the act? That's just such an empty argument by James Wilkes. And I think that everyone listening to this saw the fallacy in what he was saying. It's just, I hear, and it's just come up a lot of times in our conversation, like, look at where the consensus has been. Like, the consensus is basically meaningless.
Yeah. Yeah, my mom was adhering to the consensus diet for I mean, largely
listening
for
to experts.
Yeah, listening to experts. And experts have overseen the public health crisis. You know, I mean, it's not like we don't have elected experts, you know, in high levels of office who are constructing these dietary guidelines and allowing food manufacturers to make the claims that they make, you know, on their boxes saying this is heart healthy and this is not. And so I just don't put any stock in that appeal to authority at all. And it was painful. I mean, just to touch on that debate a little bit, it was painful to watch. So, yeah, I think that people, we live in an amazing time where we have experts with all different types of backgrounds, you know? So I'm not going to say that you're not an expert if you don't have a PhD or an MD after your name, you know? I mean, you clearly are an expert, but I think that there's a lot of expertise to be gleaned from, you know, others out there who have done their research and have, you know, taken the time to do their homework and are rigorous in their studies. And, you know, I mean, I would certainly call Chris Kresser an expert, you know, for example, just to touch on that.
Absolutely.
Because James, you know, was just railing on him, and I thought it was so unfair. He was such a skilled combatant and, you know, I mean, he immobilized him so early on with that, and he would just like sort of harp on it over and over and over again. But needless to say, yeah, I think that we live in a great time where, you know, the information is out there. It's free if you're, most of it is anyway. And if you're able to have an open mind and to really put in the time that it takes to educate yourself and to ask the right questions, you know, I think that you can learn a lot, and you don't have to go to, you know, through the academic route to go through that route to understand how it is to best feed yourself and your family.
And you touched on this earlier, and we can maybe close with some of these thoughts. The trick, I think, for most people is just understanding what is true and sorting out the wheat from the chaff, to use probably not the most appropriate, analogy, metaphor. But there is this, I think it's just hard. We are truth seekers, and we're trying to help people understand what is true and what is not, because there is a whole other side that would disagree with many of the things that we've said, and both of us can't be right, right? Either meat is good for you or meat is bad for you, right? Like, I don't know that it's really in the middle, and I don't like to draw black and white conclusions, but, you know, arguments from plant-based pundits are either wrong or they're right. Like, they're either wrong or right. And so it's clearly, it's not going to be a gray area for the most part. And so it's about us doing our best from the most sincere place that we can to help people understand what is true and what to do to achieve good health. And I wanted to ask you a little bit, you were saying something about honesty, and I just wanted to ask you about that so we can circle back to there from an honest perspective. We've talked about wanting to be truth seekers. There's a great quote in your book that I want you to share with the audience. And then tell me a little bit about how you think we can live honestly, because I love this concept of radical honesty and authenticity, and I'd love to hear how you live that in your own life. And you were talking about it earlier, your mom kind of instilled that in you.
Yeah. So the quote in the book that I think you're referring to is from A Cloud Atlas, written by David Mitchell. It was a book, and then it became a movie. I think it's an amazing movie, not a perfect movie, but one of my favorite movies. And that is that, you know, truth is singular. Its versions are mistruths. And I just think that living honestly and living in a way that you're living your truth. I mean, to me, what it means is just, I think it's being, you know, it's being upfront with yourself and facing, you know, the reality of your life, the ups and downs, the ins and outs, and projecting that forward in a way that is, you know, that has, I guess, like, you know, it's one of the four agreements, but be impeccable with your word. I think it's, you know, being honest with about your intentions, about your motives, and sharing what you know, and then being upfront about what you don't know. I think that's all part of the equation, and never deliberately misleading people. I mean, that's basically it in a nutshell. I mean, that's how I sort of approach my life and my work. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why, like, you know, my book, Genius Foods, everything that I've, you know, done up until this point has reached people, because I think it's easier said than done. And there's a lot of people in our space, in the health and wellness space, and the nutrition space, where, you know, there really isn't that degree of honesty. And, you know, sometimes it comes out in the wash, and it's not very, you know, it's not a good look when it comes out after the fact. You know, for example, the documentary Game Changers, I think when Game Changers first came out, people were unaware that, you know, one of the major producers, executive producers in the project, was heavily invested to the tune of $140 million in a vegan protein company. And so I don't think that having financial ties automatically renders you as dishonest. In fact, I think we live in a world where we have to make money and we have to make a living, but to be able to do it as honestly as you can, I think that's crucial. For example, people reach out to me asking to sponsor me for various things now. I have, like, you know, the podcast, I have a social media following. One, you know, company wanted to come on and become like a regular sponsor of my podcast. And, they're actually, it's like a meat company, and I'm a customer of their products. I use their stuff, but I actually thought that it might not necessarily behoove me to take them on as a sponsor, because that could, you know, create a sense of impartiality, you know, like it could make me seem partial to like the meat industry and things like that. And I kind of feel like, you know, I mean, if you know me, you know that I'm an omnivore, but I wouldn't want people to ever like second guess the advice and information that I'm giving them because I'm, you know, taking money, for example, from a company, even though I might really like the practices of the company. To me, being transparent about you know, where my motives are and my intentions, I think, is more important to me than money and things like that.
And I think people can sense that in a way. Humans are animals. We have these survival instincts, and social media is not a perfect proxy for seeing someone in person, but I have a feeling that most of our audiences can sense when we are authentic or lacking in that. And I think you and I both try to do that as much as possible, but I think we can tell who in the space is kind of kind of maybe not walking that line as rigorously as they should. And I think we're more astute than we believe, than we know we are. And we can tell as humans when we're being misled or people are sort of being a little bit, not genuine with us in the way they're presenting information. And that's, I think that I love what you said. Just speak your truth.
Speak your truth. And I also think that there's a healthy bit of skepticism surrounding people on like public figures in the social media space. People like you and me, but it's important to recognize that the influence of money, it's not exclusive to social media and people in quote unquote health and wellness podcasters and the like. I mean, when my mom was sick, we were taking her to, I believe it was Sloan Kettering or something. It was like, it's a major cancer center in New York City. And it was at that time that there was this big expose that one of the higher ups at this hospital, he was an MD, PhD, was taking money that he hadn't disclosed from pharmaceutical companies and was downplaying the potential for side effects in some of these cancer drugs that he was reporting on, or publishing on in some of his papers. And so there are unseen influences, in every industry, in every aspect of modern life. And so I think you have to kind of just be aware and privy to it and lead by example. That's what I try to do.
Yeah. I mean, I think your social media is very authentic, and knowing you as a person, I'll definitely validate you on that. So that's rad. But it's true, man. I mean, how do people know who to trust? You know, hopefully they can see in us that we're authentic and have, you know, real genuine motives.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, it's just, it's tricky, but I think, you know, I think the cream rises to the top, you know, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for coming on, my friend. The book is coming out. It's called The Genius Life. When is it out?
It's out March 17th. Super excited.
Okay. And where can people find more of your stuff online?
Yeah. So definitely come say hi over on Instagram. I'm at Max Lugavir. And then I've got my own podcast called The Genius Life, which is also the name of the book, which is now available, or I don't know when you're going to put this up, but it's available everywhere. So
sweet.
Yeah. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, pick it up.
And on the Genius Life podcast with Max, you may find a couple of episodes with me. So check those out as well. We've had some great conversations. Max is great at asking good questions and kind of we always get into some fun stuff. So closing question, my friend, what is the most radical thing?
Oh man.
That you've done recently.
The most radical thing that I've done recently. I was in Finland to keynote the Biohacker Summit recently, and it was very cold and I jumped into the Baltic Sea. That was like one of the most fun experiences. There's an amazing place in Helsinki, which is where I was, called I can't pronounce it in Finnish. It's spelled Loili, but I think it's pronounced like Lula or something like that. And it's this beautiful sauna. So if you ever make it over to Helsinki, I highly recommend checking out this place. It's a restaurant, but they've got this like epic sauna, two saunas.
Restaurant with sauna.
It's a restaurant. Yeah. Well, I told you in Finland, they're nuts about their saunas. It's like they're everywhere. It's right on the water. And I think the temperature was like 0 degrees Celsius. So I think, what is that?
Just above freezing.
Yeah. Super cold out.
That's about as cold as it gets.
Yeah, but then they literally like have steps into the water there, because I mean, you know, cold bathing is a big part of the culture there too, actually. And so yeah, I was like doing rounds of sauna followed by, you know, these dips in this cold water, and I think I stayed in it for like about, I think my max was like 10 minutes or something
in
like that.
In the cold water.
Whoa. Yeah, my max is 20 minutes in 50 degree Fahrenheit water, 10 degrees Celsius water, which I think there's a point of diminishing returns. I don't think you need to stay in it for that long. I usually will end up doing the cold immersion for 3 to 5 minutes. But it's great, man. It's like the effect that it has on me is like, and I think that it has on many people, is like almost pharmacological, and it's like, and it's in its power.
Yeah. I love cold plunges. I need to get more of those in my life. There's a study I've talked about in the past with cold water swimmers in Berlin. Hmm. And I believe they swim for an hour.
Wow.
And I don't know what the temperature is in the water in Berlin in the winter, but I imagine it's pretty cold, probably in the 40s Fahrenheit. And they're swimming for an hour. And what's cool about that study is they show that both uric acid declines first, and then glutathione declines. Hmm. Well, glutathione and uric acid both decline. I'm trying to think if there's a sequentiality there, but what they're saying is that, number one, this is an environmental hormetic. It's creating oxidative stress when you go in the cold, and it's creating, and you're seeing that because glutathione is being used up, but also that uric acid is serving as an intermediate and potentially either regenerating glutathione or doing some of the antioxidant work itself. And that's a whole other podcast about the potential antioxidant role of the human body. But both glutathione and uric acid in that study do seem to be responsive to cold water bathing, suggesting that it's a hormetic stressor, right? You're getting oxidative stress. It's using up glutathione, and then they get a super physiologic increase in glutathione afterward.
Oh, I was going to ask what the curve looked like if they did get...
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. This is kind of the idea, right? Like you were talking
about
here.
That's why we do it, yeah.
Yeah, the vigor trigger chapter in your book, like the sauna, the cold water swimming, all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's really cool awesome. Stuff. But I mean, an hour in cold water sounds brutal to me.
Yeah, I mean, cold water is amazing. I think the only context in which you wouldn't want to do it is immediately following exercise. And I don't know exactly how much of a time buffer you would want between your workout session and the cold water immersion, but it does seem to blunt some of the positive, like the adaptation effects of exercise.
Yeah, I've heard that talked about, that you don't want to do it right after exercise, but other times probably beneficial.
Yeah, I mean, based on the research that I've seen, heat seems to potentiate the effects of exercise, whereas cold seems to sort of blunt the effects.
So
the positive effects.
You go to work out, then you go in the sauna.
Yeah.
And then maybe don't take a cold shower, just take a warm shower or something and
yeah,
keep sweating.
But again, I don't know if there's any research on like on the time, like length, like how long you would want to wait necessarily, but I mean, usually if I have a good workout, I'll do like cold later in the day, but I won't immediately follow my workout with cold water immersion.
Nice. Yeah. Well, thank you for coming on, my friend. I think it's time for both of us to go eat some steak.
Yeah.
And
thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. People should check out The Genius Life, Genius Foods, and Max's podcast, which is also called The Genius Life. All right, brother. Take care, man.
Peace.
All right, everybody. Crazy times. Reach out to me if you need support. Reach out to me if you want to do a consult. You can email consults@carnivoremd. Work with me or one of the PAs I work with. I hope you are all staying safe and happy. We'll update this every week. Let me know what kind of stuff you want to hear from me in the future. Again, This is kind of an extra podcast this week. I wanted to share this conversation with my buddy Max and get it out there. His new book is something to check out. In addition to my new book, The Carnivore Code, his book is called The Genius Life. I love him dearly and want to support his work and think it is a valuable addition. And I love discourse and different opinions. But things are crazy right now with the coronavirus. I did a whole podcast earlier this week with many of my thoughts. I've been posting about it a lot. I think we're going to get through this. I think the people who are most likely to be affected are those who are elderly. So if you have elderly people in your life, protect them, quarantine them, be careful around them, and feed them some good food. You know, I think that's the take-home message. We're not powerless. It has to do with diet and lifestyle. And even if we are elderly or know people who are elderly, they are not powerless either. So maybe all be empowered. Maybe all be strong. I love and appreciate you all. My book website is thecarnivorecodebook.com. My website is carnivoremd.com. I will see you guys all next week. Stay radical. I love you all.